As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, TIFO listeners. I'm Ian McIntosh, host of the Football Manager Show by The Athletic. What do you mean you've never heard of it? Oh, you should give it a go. It's scientifically proven to make you better at Football Manager. Don't quote me on the science bit. Anyway, if you have heard of it and you're missing it, I've got good news. On May the 25th, we'll be putting on a Football Manager Masterclass. It's a sort of super pod, if you will. Tom Davidson from Sports Interactive will be in the studio with the ultimate guide to getting better at this bastard child of Skynet that masquerades as a video game. We've got Alex McLeish in the studio as well. He's going to teach real-life lessons that can help you in the game. And remember, this man played for Alex Ferguson and went on to win a major trophy with Birmingham City. And by the way, if you're under the impression that Alex is a dour, moody Scotsman, you could not be more wrong. He was our first ever guest on the Totally Football League show, and he's absolutely lovely. Kind of want him to be my real-life football friend, but let's keep that to ourselves. Don't want to scare him off. Anyway, I'm babbling away. Haven't told you the best bit. The best bit is that one ticket holder will win the chance to play Alex McLeish in a live-streamed game of Football Manager 2021 for actual prizes. Actual prizes. What's the prize? Only a bloody Nintendo Switch. What do you get if you lose? Nothing. Because this is like Football Manager Gladiators with fewer lions. Anyway, we've got loads of other prizes, books, all sorts. So, if you want to come along, it's £7. £7, that's the price of a pint if you go to the wrong pub in London. £7, and you can get that ticket by visiting link.dice.fm/masterclass. That's link.dice.fm/masterclass. I'll see you there.
Welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. There's no Joe again. He is still on holiday. There's also no Alex. He's had a couple of days without football just to, you know, cheer him up, improve his mood a little bit. So it's just me and JJ today. Hello, JJ.
Hello.
What did we talk about today? Well, we start by quizzing you a little bit, building some podcast chemistry. And then we went into Chelsea-Leicester, players fighting. We did a little bit on Manchester United and Scott McTominay. I lost my mind a little bit and had a rant about Spurs. What else did we talk about?
Well, we mostly sort of turned into the kind of pundit analysis people that I have grown up not liking.
Yeah,
using you several, just, especially me.
You did a lot of cliches today.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we endeavoured.
I was aware of them, but yeah.
We endeavour to give it 110% from here then. Before we get on with it, let me point you towards The Athletic. I've written something good on there this morning, so you can go and read that if you like. JJ, would you like to plug anything?
Seb's
your own work is fine.
It's,
yeah.
It's really very well written, very informative.
And if you're not signed up already, then you could take advantage of an excellent offer. There's 40% off for the first month, and then I think it's £4.99 thereafter. And to take advantage of that, please go to theathletic.com/TIFO. That's theathletic.com/TIFO. On with the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So, JJ, I feel as if on your first podcast, Joe did a bit of a poor job in quizzing you and getting to know you and building some podcast chemistry. So to start with today, I've prepared a series of questions to kind of explore your character and you know, to build our chemistry. I feel like we're at a 75 chemistry. If we can kind of bump up to 80 before the podcast starts, I feel like that might be advantageous.
I'm all for that. That sounds good.
Okay. So question one, which original Master League player survives the longest in your team?
Usually the quick one up front. Is it Burchett? Is that his name? Oh, there's one up front. What's his name? He's really fast. Basically, all you need is pace in that original Master League team. Ah, I always remember Jimenez. I remember his name.
Jimenez was more of a schemer. He was a kind of slightly flamboyant, looked a little bit like Steve McManaman. You know, he was a decoration. He wasn't really a foundation piece. He wasn't like a strummer who was, you know, the rock which you build any good side on.
I know his name. Castolo, that's who it was.
Nice forward. Yeah. Good finish. Okay. Question two. So, you've logged on to New Game Football Manager. You've dealt with the chairman and all his kind of, this is a great club, here's your budget. You know, do you want to meet your coaching staff? No. Do you want to meet your scouting team? No. What is the very first thing that you do?
First thing I do is set up my tactics. Very first thing I do. And then I work at what I've got in the squad to play the way I want to play and if I can do it that way. And then I start looking for players who can make that happen for me. Or I have to adapt a system that works with the ones I've got. Yeah, that's what I do.
That's quite a boring answer. I was kind of hoping for you transfer list some player that you really dislike in real life or, you know.
Oh, well, I do that now and again, but that's just like, I'll sell all the Rangers players for £1 or something like that. And then make them buy the worst players in Aberdeen for £100 million. I've done that before, plenty of times. But I take it more seriously now, so it may be boring, but it's real. And that's the, I don't know. What I also do is set up scouting, because all you need to do is scout Colombia and Brazil. And then the game kind of becomes the same after about six seasons, because you just have all the players you don't know. And then the lines between real life and your football manager team become blurred, and you're not sure whether that number nine you've got coming through as a 17-year-old is real or not.
I feel like there could be a cracking graph plotted out of how seriously you take your football manager save versus how old you are and your real life responsibilities. I feel like for different people that'd be quite a damning curve. Question three, last one, and then we must really do some football. What's your favourite type of goal netting?
Oh, I really like that question. I think, I quite like it when like someone would smash the ball and it would come like bounce back out of it, you know, so it's quite tight. Just a straight white net, doesn't have to be coloured or anything like that. That's only straight white, yeah.
But like, where do you draw the line with the tension? Because there was that, do you remember that period, probably around sort of 2005, 2006, where the goal netting, the black goal netting at Stamford Bridge was like a trampoline. And so, you know, a tap-in would bounce out to the to the centre circle. Like, where's the line? Do you want a little bit of billow? Or do you just want it?
Well, you have to get that the kind of thwack noise. You know when the ball hits the net? So it's got to, it's quite pleasing when the ball hits back in the net, gets absorbed by it slightly, and then bounces back down to the ground. That's the best, I think. If it goes in and sort of gets like wrapped around in it, like it's jelly, I don't know if I like that one so much. It's okay sometimes, but it's not as rewarding.
And favourite goal netting noise? Now, this is kind of a control question because there's really only one correct answer to this. And, you know, if you don't give it, then there's going to be atmosphere and tension throughout the rest of the podcast. But
I think it's the same one that you got when Tielemans hit that goal in the FA Cup final, where it just comes in off the net and it goes thwack. That and a bit of a rustle, you know.
Answer we're really looking for is Westfalen Stadium, but okay, we'll allow that. Ajax, Amsterdam Arena is good enough, but okay. Right, let's crack on. Chelsea, Leicester. Now, there's been quite a lot of fallout from this. There was an enormous fight at the end of it, which was very gratifying for everybody involved. But before we get to that, you wanted to, and this was interesting to me, you wanted to pick out a bit about Timo Werner and the timing of his runs. Explain.
So his greatest strength is also his biggest weakness. Oh, no, wait, that's him trying to shoot, isn't it? But it's the way he runs. So he makes these really, really smart runs into channels. So he starts in the middle, and he's playing as a nine, and he'll run in between space between a fullback and a centre-back. And he makes them a lot, and Chelsea can make these line-breaking passes that he then runs onto. Very good at doing it. But he often makes that run, the pass doesn't come, and then he just stands. He doesn't get back onside a lot. I think he's the most offside player this season in the league. Let me double check that. I sort of saw that stat on the television over the weekend. That's a problem because they keep having moves break down. I mean, you got to play on the shoulder, obviously, to play to his strengths or making these runs. But he needs to learn to do that. He must know.
I feel like we're getting into quite a strange place with Werner because I've started to see a few articles and just a few opinion pieces focusing in on his reaction to missing chances. So, like, okay, he was a little bit unlucky on Tuesday night, the two goals ruled out by VAR. But you're starting to see people saying things like, oh, yeah, but he still came on TV and, you know, smiled, didn't burst into tears. And, you know, that's the stuff that Ballon d'Or winners are made of. You know, that kind of thing. It feels like we've kind of moved into that sort of Roberto Soldado, Vincent Janssen territory with him already, which feels, I don't know, troubling.
I'm still convinced he's going to come good. I think he just needs to maybe feel settled. And it's the cliche that once he scores, he'll keep scoring. I found this offside thing. He's got 27 offsides this season, so he's not the most at the moment. He is the fourth most offside. But yeah, he still needs to improve on it. But in terms of talking about him compared to Soldado, I think it shows good. I mean, he's not a Soldado. It obviously shows a strong mental resilience to be able to pick yourself up and still be happy and keep going. And that's one of the things, if your head starts going down, that's when you start rushing things. And maybe he's a bit nervous in his head and he's not quite settled where he is. I'm convinced he'll come good and score heaps. Like his XG, which I don't know off the top of my head, must be very much higher than his actual goal scored. But I remember even like Andy Cole back in the day used to miss a heap of chances, but he was in the right place at the right time to get them and he would still score a heap of goals. So although like the absolute elite, like Harry Kane say, will, I think you can measure them often by their XG, he'll always shoot or score over his XG, which makes him that next level. And Werner has a really high XG, and that's his skill, is that he's able to get into those positions to get on the end of these moves. But, yeah. Soldado, harsh.
Soldado broke my heart a little bit. Like, he seemed like such a nice guy, and there was, we all went through it. As Tottenham supporters, like, we all kind of made our excuses. There was first, like, the kind of, yeah, but, you know, his work rate's really good. Then we went to, yeah, but he's still in position to miss the chances, which is, you know, a great virtue. And then I think I might have even written an article about it. And, you know, if you were the editor who published it, please delete it. But I think it was something along the lines of, yeah, well, you know, he's probably just a number 10. I mean, he's not really built to score goals. And it was just got worse and worse and worse. And then I remember when he left Spurs, he was sold to Villarreal. And I was watching his unveiling, and you know how like a player juggles a football and, you know, might punt it into the stand, you know, to, you know, these were pre-pandemic times, so obviously there were supporters there for the unveiling, and he did that and he missed the stand. No joke, he missed the stand. And it was just very, very difficult. And it's, I want Werner, to me, Werner is like, we've said this before, it might have been Alex and I having this conversation, but it's like, I don't necessarily need him to score a lot of goals. I think from Chelsea's perspective, if you put in a centre forward who could score 20 goals a season to that team, and you took a little bit of the emphasis and a little bit of the expectation away from Werner, who isn't really built to be, I don't think, like a 25 goal a season player, then I wonder whether his goal scoring would improve as a result of that. Because a lot of this seems to be player in his own head, trying much, much, much too hard, and doing everything a little bit too quickly as well. I wonder whether that's a kind of a route to solving this.
Yeah, I like that. Do you know actually who he's reminded me of? Castolo.
Who does snap at chances, you know, snatches a good goal scoring opportunities in your early Master League days.
Exactly. And that's largely what he's there for, right? Because, I mean, he was really good in his his previous team in Germany, Leipzig, wasn't it? My head's gone.
Yes, it was.
Yes, that's right, yeah. But you're playing as part of a two, and they're also mostly playing in transition really quick, so he's able to use his pace and acceleration and those movements where he gets offside. So Chelsea are trying to, like, under Tuchel, it's very high energy, and I mean, we saw it in this game, I'm sure we'll talk about it just now, but they're so intense, really quick, getting the ball from back to front as quickly as possible. But when they get into those, this is where he's not built for a 25 goal a season striker, is when they have all of the ball and they're in the final third, the other team's blocking them and there's no real way to get the ball into the box. I don't see, this is where Andy Cole would score more, whereas Werner is going to be much more useful for playing in certain games. Like against Manchester City in the Champions League, he'll be essential because of the way he makes those runs in behind, a constant threat. Even if you're not going to bet an awful lot of money on him scoring every chance he gets, he'll still get those chances and cause him a real danger. So, I mean, what do you think of him when he played on the left of the three?
I quite like him. I like him because he's a mismatch athletically against most defenders in those positions. Yeah. Tends to put him in space. I remember seeing him in the last Champions League game he played for Leipzig. I went out to cover that game, and that stadium is very, very high. You sit right at the back of it in the press, and you look down, and he was in the first half. He was playing on the near touchline, and he absolutely roasted Toby Alderweireld. And he didn't, when he got to the box, like, his decisions weren't always the best. But what he would do, the kind of the fractures that he would create in a defense in those areas between, like, you know, if a back three, centre back and a wing back, or a centre back and a full back, they were just devastating. It was just cut after cut after cut, and he was always free. Like, his availability and his positioning is really good, and so I like him in those positions. And I feel like if you shifted him into the center and you positioned him between a couple of center backs or maybe two and a deep midfielder, I feel like you might lose something, even if you do put him in better goal scoring positions. I don't know. That's just how it feels at the moment.
No, I know what you mean. And I mean, when he plays on the left, to me, I think, like, the best example of someone who does that just now is, like, Sadio Mane, who, I mean, he's got certain attributes that are similar to him, but I'd much prefer to have Mane there. Like, I feel he's far more dangerous in attack. He's quicker to accelerate. He's just a better player. I don't know. I think I'm still convinced Werner he'll come good for Chelsea. He's certainly very useful tactically. So I'm not writing him off just yet. He's not Soldado yet. Neither is he Cristolo, but he's more like Cristolo.
And he's definitely not Vincent Janssen. No, I don't think anyone's writing him off. I think he's been a little bit misunderstood, or missold at least. I think people, when a sign like that happens, obviously, you know, people are aware of the Bundesliga. It's covered in England. But I feel like there's a lot of people that kind of spend a couple of minutes on YouTube, see goals, and be like, right, well, that's what he should be. Alex and I did talk about that in the episode earlier this week. And it feels like people have missed the bit where Timo Werner's has always missed a lot of chances. He's always been that guy. Like, he's been a little bit feast and famine in that regard. So we shall see. But no one's writing him off.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
In your notes, I'm going to read them to you. This is your assessment of the game. Nothing wrong tactically, just momentum, attacking impetus, crowd made a difference. And then Azpilicueta is right winger, which seems kind of weirdly incongruous. Talk to me about that momentum thing. It feels quite trite to say revenge for the cup final, but essentially.
I mean, it's a weird thing. So I obviously really enjoy the tactical side of the game, and I've always been fascinated by that. And that's what I like talking about. However, you cannot deny that often the team who wins games of football tends to be the one who wants it more. It really
Two
is.
2 weeks it took you to ruin your reputation.
I know. It's happened now. But you saw, like, the difference, like, Chelsea were just so intense from the start of this game. They were so at them all of the time, and it was relentless. There wasn't much Leicester could even do. Like, they were, you know, they'd try and block them off when they could, but you saw from the very start, Azpilicueta, which I wrote as right winger, was playing like a right winger. He was pushing Luke Thomas back so deep that he couldn't possibly get out, and all of Leicester's depth came from that. But if they were then to pull, say, Maddison out to the left, they're going to lose a body in the midfield, which they needed, because Chelsea kept going through the middle of them as well. And it just felt like one of those games where Rodgers knew they were going to be up against it, and had to just try and weather the storm, keep them quiet, really try and nullify any threats. I mean, obviously, they ended up losing. But there's nothing... I don't know what I would have changed as Rodgers in that moment, and what if he could have done something differently to start the game, what he would have done. I've also written the notes, and I think it felt a lot like in Football Manager, when Chelsea had this the chance to use the assertive go out and get revenge style tactic, you know, the team talk you do.
Everyone goes green as soon as you say it, yeah.
Yeah, and you know you're going to win. It doesn't matter. There's nothing you can do against it. And Rodgers was definitely just calm, pick up where you left off, continue your good work, and try and control the game that way.
Yeah, I think it might have been a kind of just go out and enjoy yourselves moment. Like, just because you're kind of in a no-win situation. It's also, like, brings me on something else I want to talk about, which is this kind of, like, this idea that, like, that there's this binary situation whereby you either finish in the top four or you've had a bad season. And if you've occupied the top four at one stage and then fall out of it, then irrespective of any context, resources or rivalries, that's a failure, and it kind of casts a cloud over everything else you've done. And it just feels like, I know that the sequences that have contributed to Leicester slipping back a little bit in the league, but it just, I don't know, it feels quite joyless. Like, it, you know, the FA Cup final was 4 days old, and, you know, it's barely, like, when this game took place, barely 48 hours after we'd all spent, you know, our Mondays celebrating, oh, weren't they lovely scenes, and didn't Kasper Schmeichel play well, and great fans are back, to kind of, oh, they fucked it, bottlers, again. And I'm a little bit sick of it. The kind of this, I know it's not a new debate, but the top four is everything. That's the measure of everybody's season. Now, it's tedious.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess it's the sign of progress in the league, and it's the amount of money they get in, and it does all come down to money. I mean, I think the romantics will say that the FA Cup final was they'd much rather that than a Champions League place. But a Champions League place can change your club forever, because if you are then able to sustain that, the money that comes in and the prestige associated with being in the Champions League means you can attract a certain level of player, which means you can then compete at an even higher level and go from there. I mean, I'm sure you get it too. Like, it makes total sense. But also, like, same as Rodgers on that note, whether it's it swings on only the achievement of the manager. Like, he didn't suddenly become an elite manager because he won the FA Cup. If he'd lost that final, he would still be one of the best managers in Europe just for getting them there. If that fits into it.
No, I definitely agree. But I think that's a product of it being kind of the age of, you know, 15 conclusions at every game. Like, that, it's that, like, we have to learn something. You have to think differently about something to how you did 90 minutes before. I don't disagree, like, with the Champions League point in terms of kind of, like, its use in plotting a route through the game. Of course that makes sense. And of course it's entirely logical. I just think it's a little bit joyless to go from celebrating what Leicester have achieved to, yeah, but they're probably going to finish fifth. Feels, it's a bit of a buzzkill moment. And I don't dispute the importance of the Champions League, and, you know, it has superseded the FA Cup. I accept that completely. But at the same time, like, you can pause for just a little bit longer before you damn teams. Like, sometimes you can, you know, celebrate a few things in isolation. Talking of that, the next line in the notes is just, this is my contribution to this section, it just says fight! And this was, it felt quite for the sake of it. Like, it wasn't sort of, there was a lot of hold me back going on in that fight, I felt. Did you see it?
Yeah, I I mean, I love when these things happen. I know you're not supposed to. Everyone does.
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
great.
Oh, you hate
fun.
To see it. Yeah.
Oh, it's so exciting. Like,
bad old days.
Up in your chair. Yeah, I love it. Because I think I love it because it's it feels so controlled and very, let's hold me back. You know, there's no one's actually getting destroyed or hurt.
Yeah,
it's just kind of, oh, yeah. Nothing's actually going to happen. I thought it's quite funny that Daniel Amati's getting involved and they like recognize him. It's like, that's the guy.
He's not playing, but that's him.
Why is he doing it? Like, was he getting involved?
For people that missed this, so that the aggravation seemed to be traced back to some footage that was taken from the Leicester changing room at Wembley after the FA Cup final when Daniel Amati threw a Chelsea pendant over his shoulder. And that's like, feels like that's a kind of, you know how everyone says, oh, you know, it's just like spitting's the worst thing in the whole of football. Like, you know, you could cut off my head and kick me in the bollocks. That's fine, but just don't spit at me. It's that, isn't it? Like, you've disrespected our colours. And it's this, it's just a really kind of, I don't know, it's just, it's very sport just to get wound up by something like that.
It's
I don't
really
know why.
Silly. It seems quite really pathetic silly. Even, isn't it? And I mean, yeah. I really hope they don't start including, like Snapchat moments as ways to rev up an opposite team in Football Manager or something. It's just him being a bit of an idiot, throwing a thing. He thinks he's being cool on camera on his phone or whatever.
It's young player gets a little bit lost in the moment. It's kind of forgivable. Like
exactly.
I'm a big fan of the America's Game series, which is just like it's like an hour long documentary which focuses on like past Super Bowl winners. And it's fun. It's got good music. I like the action and the slow mo. And yeah, it's cool. But in nearly every episode, there's a moment where, like, there's always this kind of, like, faux motivational tactic that a coach employs where he says, you know, 3 days before the game, someone called me in the week and said, actually, I think you'll find your opposition have already booked their plane tickets to the Super Bowl. And he tells his team and he makes this great thing about, you know, creating bulletin board material and kind of, right, so, you know, go and shove that down their throats. And it's just like, stop it. Just stop
it. Do you know when they always say, like, oh, we stuck that up in the dressing room wall just to show them? Like, like that'll inspire them. It reminds me of, like, someone's always got a friend who has won an accumulator once, and they always tell you about that, but they never tell you about the million times they've never won anything. And it's the same way that they're never telling you the amount of times they put an inspirational poster of Antonio Rudiger on their wall and no one has cared.
can you imagine if a coach literally did that? So say you and I were playing in an FA Cup final, and, you know, biggest day of your career, you walk into the dressing room and there's no tactics boards. Instead, it's just a few printouts of Cesar Azpilicueta's Instagram account and the coach is pointing. You think, you lost your mind. That's not motivating me. I don't care about that. Tell me what. Because that stuff, I've heard coaches talk about that kind of thing, and they say that, like, the motivational, like the Churchillian speech aspect of team talks lasts about 6 minutes. You know, you go onto the pitch, a bit of adrenaline, everyone's a bit pumped up, and then you kind of rely on all the technical instructions. If you had a coach that just said, yeah, you want to see what he's doing to your pendant, that's outrageous. The idea that kind of like you got Timo Werner and Kai Havertz frothing at the mouth at the idea that, like, Daniel Amati, who's Daniel Amati? Like, they don't, you know, they're not even playing against Daniel Amati. Good player, but he, you know, he wasn't relevant in this game, really. Right, enough on that, because you want to talk about Man United Fulham, 1-1. Lovely goal from Edison Cavani. Haven't seen a chip like that since, you ask. Actually, Kylian Mbappe came very, very close to doing it last night against Monaco. That kind of deft, gentle, feathered chip came off the bottom of the bar in the French Cup final. But what else do you enjoy? You were discouraged by what happened to Man United after Scott McTominay was subbed.
Yeah, I think they lost a bit of control in the game. I think you, it's a good example of when maybe it's not a tactical change taking McTominay off, just trying to rest him, make sure he's ready for the Euros to beat England. But you have to...
I'm not rising to that.
No. Well, just testing the waters. So. Our chemistry is going to be 100 soon, and then this will help us get there.
Yeah, we're about 82, so you know, just give it a week.
I really like Scott McTominay. I think he's come on an awful lot, especially this season, and is one of the leaders of that team. And really important to how they play. And when he comes off, they lose something. Maybe it's a bit of snap, a bit of leadership. This is something they miss. And they lost control of the game. I mean, it's Fulham. But this game had a really pre-season friendly feel to it. Very odd. I mean, in front of a crowd is Old Trafford, who seemed bored for most of it. I don't blame them because it was not a great match. And that's one of the things that, like, I like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as a manager. I'm one of the only ones in the world who seems to. And that's probably the one thing I think you can really, really hold him up to, is that his players don't turn it on when they need to. They're just not, like, pumped up. What they need is a picture of Cesar Azpilicueta's Instagram in the dressing room before each game.
let's go back to that, because you like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I don't hate Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I just don't. I don't want him sacked or, like, fired into the sun or anything. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to like about him as a coach, not as a person. I'm sure he's a very, very nice man, but just what is it that you like about him?
Well, I think there's not one particular way to play football. I don't think the best manager in the world, like Pep Guardiola or something, and you can see Jurgen Klopp's been with him as well the last little while, and they have very defined styles of play. But Carlo Ancelotti, for example, does not have one defined style of play. He will merge a team out, merge? Form. Merge. Come on,
forge.
Now.
Forge. Forge. Somewhere between.
Got it. He will forge a team out of whatever players he has and devise a system around it. He's used every system in the book, and there are books. And that's, I'm getting away from my point of Solskjaer, but Solskjaer is maybe not the best coach in the world, but he is a manager, and there's a difference between them. And he's trying to do something very difficult in restoring Manchester United to where they were. They really lost their identity in their way, and I think he's doing a good job of restoring that. And also, people always think, like, oh, he's not a good coach because Man United players haven't improved. It's not just the manager doing coaching, it's the coaching staff. Like, if you go into a team, you have a whole bunch of employees that you hire. He's got Mick Phelan there, who is basically running the team under Sir Alex Ferguson towards the end. Like, he was doing a lot of the tactical work. He would be doing first team coaching. I mean, back in, you know, Alex Ferguson, greatest manager of all time.
Did very little coaching.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Certainly did at Aberdeen and in the younger days of Manchester United, but that's because he knew he could always have his voice being heard. He needed a variety, and his way was keeping a certain, and this is going back to my kind of football man comments earlier of it doesn't always matter tactically, it's about who wants it more. He was able to cultivate that culture, winning culture, determined, driven, aggressive dressing room that you need to be able to be a serial winner. And I think Solskjaer's doing that. I've noticed his demeanour's gone from being quite calm and I'm Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I'm really nice, to being second is not an achievement. Quite, you know, he's definitely got a character arc.
Yeah, you're right. That evolution has happened quite quickly, hasn't it?
Yeah. I think we're getting to, we're probably in the second act of Solskjaer just now, which means there's going to have to be a dip at some point before the third act, but we're probably past the point of no return. In his Man United career. And I'm liking this analogy that I'm going with, and I'm going to keep using it from now on.
No, I think that's really interesting, because actually that player improvement point is really interesting, because I'm reading Carlo Ancelotti's book at the moment, and it's, of all the kind of the manager autobiographies I've read, it's probably the one that focuses the most on culture. He talks a little bit about, you know, footballing style and players too, but...
Is this the Quiet Leadership book, that one?
Yeah, a lot of space in it is dedicated to cultivating family and culture and developing relationships and kind of creating the conditions where coaching can have the biggest impact. And there have always been, like, these two schools. Like you mentioned, like Ferguson did very little coaching, handed it over to, you know, that's why United seemed to rise and fall so often on the work of his assistants. Like, there were different eras marked out by, you know, McLaren or Kiros or whoever, Renny Mullenstein. But you can go back to someone like, oh, I don't know, Brian Clough. Like, you know, when Nottingham Forest won those two European Cups, they barely saw him during the week. Like, you know, there was Peter Taylor there doing, you know, I don't know whether Peter Taylor led coaching specifically, but Clough would sometimes go on holiday during the week, or he'd be doing his TV work down in London for LWT or, you know, whatever. And so, like, the idea that a manager is always personally and directly responsible for how player X is playing, not really true. Sometimes I guess it's a tonal thing, isn't it?
I think so. And another thing I found really interesting in I've had a lot of interviews I've done with various coaches and managers, specifically to ask them, how come this player's got so good? Like, I'd spoke to Sean Dyche once about Ashley Barnes. I spoke to Derek McInnes, who's the Aberdeen manager, about a guy called Simon Cosgrove. And what they always say is, like, they provide the parameters within which the player can improve. They put on the best coaching sessions that they can, and it's going to be designed for player improvement and also to suit the tactical needs of the team. I know, and they've got to try and manage people as well at the same time. But it's always down to the individual players to improve, which is why, like, Ronaldo is a hyper example. He didn't get good because he had the best coaching available and because Alex Ferguson was his manager. He got to be the best because he is insane and would train relentlessly like a maniac. And that's how he got there. And certain players, you look at the Gary Neville, not the most talented of players, but you know the common story is that he just worked harder than everyone else. That's how he got to where he was.
There were some really really interesting stories about Gary Neville when he was a young player at Man United. Apparently, I think this comes from David Beckham's book or something like that. But you say that Gary Neville wasn't the best crosser, and every time he would put in a bad cross, and Peter Schmeichel would claim it, like Schmeichel would mock him. And you'd imagine being mocked by Peter Schmeichel is pretty, like, you know, eviscerating experience. And it was kind of like it needled Neville to the point where he just got better and better and better. And by the end of his career, Gary Neville is one of the best crossing fullbacks in the country, if not Europe. And actually, you know what? Like that, I'm convinced that like to be a world class player, you have to be a little bit of a sociopath. Like you have to
100%, 100%.
Yeah, and like the kind of like a lot of these players, like they're weird. That as people, they are strange. Weird's the wrong word. That's not right. They are very different and socially a little bit peculiar. Like you think of Harry Kane buying a house next to Tottenham training ground. That's strange. Like that's like.
Did he do that?
Yeah, he did that so he could be closer to it. And you know the kind of the gym setups players build in their houses and the kind of like. You know, the nutritional discipline. These are not normal person characteristics in the same way that, like, you know, I'll go have a coffee and, you know, I'll maybe, you know, that sausage roll looks nice and, you know, I'll get a, you know, McDonald's. Like, to live your life with that much discipline is admirable, but to have that and the drive and the kind of, to get to the top of the game and not just go, well, this is pretty great and just slacken off. Like, because that's a normal person's response to it, isn't it? Whereas Ronaldo and Messi, like these guys, like endless quest for self-improvement. And that's just, that's bizarre.
I agree with everything you've just said.
From really good things and self-improvement, I'm not going to subject you to this, JJ, because I know you didn't watch it, but I'm just going to have a little rant about Tottenham against Villa, because it was absolutely horrendous. It was one of the most chaotic performances I've seen from Tottenham. Felt like the cycle ended a long time ago. I suppose this felt like an end of era performance. It's like all of this has got to go. This is just rubbish. It was it was loose and confused. I was a couple of the Athletic's Tottenham writers are Jack Pitbrook is doing a lot of England work at the moment ahead of the Euro, so I kind of helped out and mucked in with a little piece, and I got 500 words into it yesterday. I had to delete the whole lot because it was just too nasty. I just thought there's no way this is getting published. It's just so I'll just start that again. That's out now if you want to read the kind of the modified version. But it was a perfect storm as well, because I finished I full time went and I was writing my article, and every now and again I would look up to see what was happening in the other games. And every time I looked up, something worse was happening. So I think the first time, you know, West Ham equalised, then they went ahead in the last minute, and then they got their third. And I was like, okay, fine. Did a bit more work. Half an hour later, looked up. You know, Crystal Palace have equalised, holding on against Arsenal. That's good. At least there's going to be an... Oh, no. There's the Arsenal winner. There's the Arsenal third. So a pretty rubbish night. JJ, pick me up. Let's go somewhere else in the pod.
I watched the second half of that game.
Sorry.
No, it's all right. They were awful. However, I mean, Sergio Reguilón's own goal was magnificent. Like it was.
Yeah.
Even as a Spurs fan, you must have enjoyed that.
Well, I enjoyed it the first time he did it, because he tried the same thing against Leeds, but Lloris made a really good save. This time it was slightly further out, different level of difficulty, a little bit worse from Lloris, slightly more towards the far corner, good finish, I guess. Reguilón, I still think Reguilón is a good player, but he's just mentally, he seems to have been shot to pieces by events of the past few weeks. You were going to tell me what the XG was in this game, and then we agreed that I would respond to it naturally.
Yes.
Spontaneously. Okay. Tell me. In fact, let me guess. Let me guess. Let me guess first.
Go for it.
I will guess that Villa got to about 3.6.
You are wildly incorrect.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's not as exciting as you might thought. This is actually not a very good anecdote or example of anything. Spurs had an XG, according to Wyscout, of 1.43, and Aston Villa had an XG of 1.55.
Yeah, that's a flaw in the old metric, that one.
Data.
I think, like, I would say Villa didn't create... Actually, maybe not, because Villa didn't create many good scoring opportunities. They got in position to create those chances quite a lot, and they cut through very, very easily, and it was an absolute shambles. And I think had this been... I mean, Villa's season is over. So had this been 3 months ago, this could have been 4 or 5. And I don't think anybody at Tottenham could have had any complaints. They were absolutely miserable. And you have asked the question on the plan. Seb, what are Spurs and what are they going to be next season? JJ, I would say they will still be shit. Let's move on. Palace 1, Arsenal 3. Ugh, just leave this one. I don't have the heart for it.
Yeah,
there's a point about you have mentioned how intense Wilfried Zaha's eyes are. I really like the way that Wilfried Zaha celebrates goals. Like he sort of, it's so authentic, and he kind of tenses up and like he's just so happy. I don't know. Does anyone else notice that? I don't know.
I think whenever I see him outside of football, not that I'm hanging out with him. I mean, like on TV or YouTube or something. I'm not friends with Wilfried Zaha, but I would be. He seems like a nice boy. That's giving me a point.
Doesn't he?
He seems really happy and lovely. He's like a nice guy. Yeah. On the pitch, he's a maniac. He just seems like he's really disagreeable, super focused, hyper intense. Is always seeming to have it's like he's always talking to someone who isn't there angrily about everything. He doesn't look happy about anything that's going on around him. I don't blame him for a lot of the season. It's been dreadful to be playing for this Palace team. I don't think his football life has gone quite as he wished it would have.
Do you think the nadir was when he got mocked by that Watford mascot? Do you remember when he like mimicked his or claimed that he dived and the mascot was just on the side of on the touchline, just dived in his full Hornet costume?
I don't remember that, but that sounds like the kind of thing that could then haunt him forever. So all he's doing is thinking about that mascot and how one day...
Honestly, I think about that mascot quite a lot. So if you go to Vicarage Road, that mascot, he's a fine mascot, like does a lot of, you know, good mascot stuff. However, at half time, he goes into the press room, or at least he used to, for a cup of tea, and he takes off his Hornet's head and he's still got his Hornet body on. And as you'd imagine, like if you wear a costume that looks like that, you are very, very sweaty. So you come in and you come in at half time to like get your water or your, you know, pie or whatever. And there's this huge Hornet just sitting there, really sweaty man looking on top of it. Like he's very good. It's just a weird thing. And it's what I think of every time I go to Watford or every time I used to go there.
I love mascots.
Yeah, don't people shouldn't say that we don't take them, you know, behind the scenes on this podcast. Like, you know, it's the really precious insight that we give them.
A melted hornet. I would say one thing about Arsenal in this game is that I thought they were really quite good for a lot of the game without producing anything. But interesting how they suddenly turn that on when there's nothing really to play for, no peril or pressure. Like, they just... they don't have any of the mental fortitude required to get where they need to go just yet.
I was eavesdropping on some conversations between some Arsenal Twitter accounts last night, and one of the things I saw was people saying, because the goals they scored were artistically very nice, they mean very intricate bits of play, you know, very well worked. But a couple of people were saying either they score those goals or they don't do anything at all. What does that mean?
I think they remind me, all of them remind me of players on five-a-side who are really good technically. But they always end up in the losing team. What you need is players who maybe aren't that good, but will just run to chase everything they want it more. Oh no.
That's the fourth time you've done that.
I'm not even doing a callback. Like, for comedy purposes, it is just, that's, it's just what they lack. And they'll turf out some players, and you've seen, I mean, the team he named is very young. Arteta, I'm saying the team he named is very young. Aubameyang's the only player over 30, I think it was in the entire team. And like Pepe, for example, he often does tricks at the wrong times. Clearly, like, an outstanding player, but always does it at the wrong times. I thought against Palace, he was able to do it at the right times. His goal was superb. But, I mean, yes, that's him just sort of trying it in the sixth minute of injury time when they've already won the game. They need to be doing more for the rest of it. They just lack real grit. Tierney is the only one in that team who I think teams... Well, Saka's a good player as well, actually. I'm just tying myself in knots, really. But Tierney.
Saka's a good player. I like Smith Rowe. I still don't. Two concerns with him. I still don't know. I don't know what his long term position is. I know he's a really good attacking player, and I would want him in that side, definitely. I don't know what his role is. Also, I don't know quite what he needs to be surrounded by and supported by to grow as you'd want him to. That doesn't feel like. I think that's just a kind of. He needs to develop a little bit, maybe. But I do like him. I think he's a smashing player. Smashing player. Jesus. That's a,
oh no. We are becoming football men. Like, we're sort of morphing.
This never
we're
happened.
Evolving,
like, you know, when it was Joe, Alex, and I. Like, this was highbrow conversation, and now it's just two of us. We've had like players, you know, not wanting it enough. No one's giving 110%, and I'm talking about smashing players. Like, this is I've been infected. Let's end. Let's end on in Italy, because I'm interested to get your opinion on something. I didn't have the opportunity to watch this game in full, but I watched the extended highlights of Atalanta losing the Coppa Italia to Juventus last night. And another really good performance from Federico Chiesa, who I started out thinking was a bit of a kind of gangly tryhard. Like, he runs in quite a funny way, and like, I'm always a little bit suspicious of a player who, you know, had a professional footballer as a dad. You think, you know, are you? Yeah, I'm unfair. I'm unfairly judging, but he is. I think he's great. I think he does so many things really well. What do you like him?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Like, I sometimes he seems like a really. There's a game he played that I watched. And he scored twice in it. What was the game? I think it was the Champions League.
Was that in the Champions League game?
Yeah.
When he scored the header against, that was him against Porto.
That's the one, yeah. And I thought he looked great there. Like, obviously, he's got good physical attributes. He's very quick. He's good at dribbling. He technically is a strong enough player, decent movement. But I don't know if he's a next level player, if that makes sense. Like, he might be in the tier below the top.
I suppose. I wonder, like, what you tend to notice with him is, is sometimes his combinations with Ronaldo are really excellent. And on the one hand, good, because, you know, you want a player that's on the same wavelength as someone like that. That's obviously beneficial to the side. On the other, you wonder how much, because that comment about him being next level, you wonder how much opportunity he'd get in a side without Ronaldo. Like, where... Like, Ronaldo is clearly the main goal scoring focus in that side. Like, defensively, like, that's where your attention is drawn. Is Chiesa someone who's capitalizing on that? I don't know. I'm not suggesting he is or he isn't. I just don't know. And I suppose that's a little bit of a query going forward. But I like him. I like him. I probably shouldn't have called him a gangly tryhard. That's a bit harsh. But I was wrong with that. He's a very, very good player. And I've enjoyed watching him, and I've enjoyed the podcast and chatting to you, JJ. We shall be back on Tuesday. Joe will be back on Tuesday with stories from his holiday, hopefully. I began the week by reminding everyone at TIFO that let's let him have a holiday and don't interrupt him if you don't need to. And then I set the example by calling him at 8:45 one morning on the second day. So he will shout at me. I think he told me directly to fuck off when I did that. Anyway, we'll be back next week and look forward to that. Bye-bye.
The Athletic.